This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released May 4th, 2019. Episode 440.3. Interviews with Anul, AJ, Uriel, Stee, and Craig. KaiCon 2019. Who are you guys and what are you guys talking about just now?
Hi, my name is Anul. I'm from Mumbai and I just did a talk on using FreeCAD to design components for use with KaiCAD.
I'm AJ Keller. I work for Neurosity. We make wearable computers and I just learned about how to import a 3D model onto my KaiCAD and how to align the 3D model on the footprint.
What is the hard part about 3D with mechanical and electrical stuff? What's the deal there?
With mechanical, my biggest pain point has been the lack of proper design data from the manufacturer. So it all starts from there. Without that, you can't make accurate models. And that's a problem.
How many manufacturers are actually providing the models? Because I know some of them do, but I don't know how.
No, in fact, all of them do. They always give a dimensional drawing.
No, but like, do they not give you step files?
No, not all.
Right, that's what we're wrong. We want the finished product, right?
I don't think a lot of them do.
Right, that should be what's like.
I mean, they all have it,
again.
Right?
Like, exactly. It's not like they're doing the paper cardboard models in their facilities, you know?
No, but step files, not everyone, and even the flat 2D drawings.
They're crappy sometimes.
They're pretty crappy sometimes. You have to calculate back a lot of dimensions and.
Especially for footprints. It's all relative measurements everywhere.
Yeah. Exactly. He just pointed out we loaded like a 3D model onto my footprint, and he was like, "Oh, it's on top of your silk screen."
Yeah,
but it was like literally off, and we just caught it. Yeah. You know, it's not the biggest thing.
Oh yeah, centering it and stuff.
Well, it was centered, but it was sitting on. I had used silk to create the bounding lines of where I thought based on the mechanical drawing.
Right.
And then we loaded the step file they gave us and it's over both of my boundaries.
Right.
That's good to check, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing we caught was when he imported the step file, it was so far away from the origin that it wouldn't be visible in his screen. Mm-hmm. So he was wondering where it is and he couldn't find it.
Oh, yeah.
And then we kind of zoomed out and we say, well, it's way off origin. So that's like a design error because it wasn't made with the right coordinates.
And that actually has been blocking me for like 2 years.
Wow. So AJ, what are you using this kind of stuff for? It sounded like you need 3D stuff because of your actual design constraints.
Yeah. So we're using KiCad to make print circuit boards that go in wearable headsets. And these wearable headsets have like 5 or 6 circuit boards. Some are flex, some are rigid. And connecting all of these together is really cool. But one big thing that I thought KiCad, like I couldn't do with KiCad, is export the PCB like exact STLs such that the design teams could then import them and create stuff and create casings for it and get it right on the first try. So a lot of what we end up doing is iterating and using 3D printing to then iterate, and that wastes time and money.
Right. Yeah, even if you're sending out for boards, sending out for boards is a long time, but even 3D printing takes, 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever, so.
Yeah.
I remember, I recall you said STL. Remember, with 3D printing, you're mostly working with STL files.
Yeah.
But when you're doing CAD, you always want a non-mesh format. So STL is a mesh format.
Yep.
You want more CAD-specific formats like STEP.
Can you export STEP from the KiCad STEP up?
Yes, that's
yes,
right.
You can.
So that's the interchange format, really. Yeah. So like STL is the finalized. It's kind of like I think about like a Word doc versus PDF. PDF's like an STL, right? You can't really go backwards from that. But Word docs, you can still.
So STL contains just the surface information. So there's nothing inside it. It's all hollow, basically.
Which is what we care about for the model, unless you're doing other stuff. I guess.
That's right.
But for a long time, so like that's the thing. I think it was 5.0. One of the steps, I guess. Maui, I remember on the forums, did a lot of the step stuff at the beginning.
It had
steps.
To be 5.0 because it used to be only be WRLs that worked.
Yeah. Those weird formats.
Yeah, I never heard of that format.
Was it VRML? That's the one?
VRML is, virtual reality modeling language.
Oh, that's where it came from. Okay.
So it was
VR has been a long time,
Yeah. It's come from NIST, actually.
Okay.
And was the only way in the old days of the web when you could have 3D models. They were all done with VRML format.
So like for Second Life and stuff like that?
Yeah.
That's cool. So when you're doing like brain-computer interface type stuff, like, I mean, you need to have that. Is it like because the shape of the cranium is changing so much or just the rounded corners? Or like what are some of the
The big thing is that, yeah, we have to create a headset that is like one size fits most, right? Yeah. So, and everyone's head, it's amazingly
different.
It's amazing how different every single person's head is.
Yeah.
And so we use flex printed circuit boards on the parts of the hardware that's actually bending and conforming to the head.
Yeah.
And we have like a little bit of rigid on the back of it that doesn't actually move. And so then it's actually able to grip and conform your head so that you're able to get contact on all the sensors that are all over your head.
That's great. What else is, so both of you, I mean, like the mechanical side, is there something that's still kind of missing that you'd be like, I wish I could have this, you know? Or is it more making do as it is right now, you know?
Well, I think the fact that we quite often have to end up teaching ourselves a lot delays our projects a lot, because quite often we spend time just trying to teach ourselves how things get done.
Right. Well, then you have to give a workshop about it too,
exactly.
So that takes a lot more time.
So documentation, I mean, makers are already doing a lot of that work. They're putting out videos, but we want more of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never enough. Makers, I mean, hackers.
People
are putting
not
stuff
a company
out.
Called makers,
no,
but
no, no.
makers.
No.
Yes.
People like us,
yeah.
You and me, yeah. Who spend time, you know, recording stuff so that others learn out
absolutely.
Of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
it's still in everyone's kind of website or
also,
feed. It's
yeah.
not central
yeah.
information.
Yeah.
Inside KiCad, actually putting, you know, like if there's something like stuck, you know, when you're actually on the 3D screen, like not seeing your model, click here to understand how to align that.
Yeah, we need a Clippy.
We need a Clippy for 2019.
I stuck for, you know, a long time on this, and he just imported it, and they were way apart, and I was like, oh, wow. So,
that's
know,
a really, it's like a frustrating feeling, too, when, like,
Well, you don't even know what to look
when
for.
You don't know what to
videos.
Google for,
yeah.
right?
It
that is the hardest
show
thing.
Up.
Yeah. Yeah, and everyone's having so much success online with these like beautiful things. I'm just looking at this
empty
this footprint. I'm like, oh,
square turd that I made.
I'll try again. I'll try again in 2 months.
Yeah, yeah, I know, right? It's that really frustrating
yeah.
feeling. And
so I think finding and I, this conference is amazing because it's just like put all these people together here, and I feel like such a novice. I've been able to do so much, but. You know, it's amazing to be able to learn these things. Yeah. There's like five things I want to learn this week and cement them all and get that done.
Well, and it's a user conference, which is the one thing that I usually go to developer. Or,
sure.
And this is like, no, we're all the same. Like, we're all trying to use it. We're all trying to learn.
I think even like the experts that you're talking about, like the people are like doing all these amazing things online. I think that's kind of like the Facebook effect as well, where it's like, well, yeah, you're seeing that end product kind of thing. It's not like you're not seeing all the words or the, you know, they maybe were struggling as well. It's like, that's a tough thing to do, you know?
So. Super fun though. I mean,
I'm glad you guys are here.
Given a choice, I'd always go to a KiCad user conference than a KiCad developer conference for sure.
Well,
because that's
if you
gotta write
C++
right? in one of them.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Right now we're writing C++. Let's do this.
Yeah.
I'm good.
So the next time around, I think we should actually see if we can get FreeCAD on board as well, because the two are coming together really well.
Yeah.
This great integration and. I don't know who the FreeCAD devs are, but maybe you should reach out to them.
Well, but if it's just users, I mean, at least
it doesn't matter.
Get the users
together,
right?
Yeah.
Do like an open source software general kind of
user
conference. Yeah,
because I feel like a lot of the open source conferences are developers specific.
Yeah. Like, initially I was very hesitant because I didn't know my talk was on FreeCAD, so I didn't know if it would be a right fit or even if it would be accepted for the conference.
Yeah.
But I think, this is something that needs to be...
What's the thing? Like, so, like, we
talk
talked about,
more
like,
about
if we were just going to talk about, like, here's what I click in KiCad, it's like, okay, that's not as interesting, but it is the stuff around it, right? How you're using it, how you're struggling with it, like, that kind of stuff is what I'm personally interested in, because...
Yeah, otherwise it's just a video and, like...
Yeah, exactly, right? You know, make that once. But it's like, if you look at projects over and over again, you're going to be like, oh, my God, they do that way? Like, that's something that you really need to...
Or you have the second person looking at, like, oh, it's just off the screen, like... Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Like that's not. You're not gonna upload a video saying like, "Well, I don't see my part," right?
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I wish someone did.
Right.
No, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, but.
Right.
Yeah. Quite often, I've looked at videos trying to figure out a problem or a solution, and there's no mention of it at all. And I'm looking at the video for 5 minutes, and I say, "Come on, this is my problem. How do I solve it?" And it ends, and still don't know.
And then there's a comment like, "Oh, I figured it out."
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to us today, guys. That's
thank
great.
You. Thanks
for
having us.
For putting this on. It's an amazing opportunity.
Where can people find you online if you do want to be found?
You can find me online best on Twitter at Anul, A-N-O-O-L.
That's a hell of a hashtag or a handle you got there. That's
you.
And likewise, you can find me at NeurosityCo, NeurosityCo on Twitter, or Andrew J. Keller, J-A-Y.
Nice.
And I'm around.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Amp Hour Day 2 at the KiCon. This is Alvaro, and I'm here with Uriel?
Yeah. Close enough.
How do you say it?
It's actually pronounced Uriel, but I gave up on that many years ago when I moved to the States.
Okay.
Now you can just point and laugh.
I can relate. I'm from Mexico, so my name has been mispronounced many times. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm for a living, I'm a software engineer. I'm based in New York, and after going to Burning Man for the first time in 2011, I became an electronics guy in my spare time. So it means I go to work and I do engineering, and then I want to relax at home, so I do more engineering.
Yes.
And I heard of KICON. I think I actually found it over Reddit, and I suggested the talk, and it got accepted, and here I am.
Oh, what was your talk about?
So I have a project that had a very elaborate PCB for an LED matrix that I've done, and just doing it by hand and placing hundreds of components at angles of 37 or 217 degrees seemed very, very tedious.
Yeah.
So I did what every software engineer would do, and I automated it. And the result is an open source C# library that allows you to take a programmatic approach into laying out PCBs.
And so is this similar to the Skittle?
So Skittle works on the schematic side of thing, and what it will eventually output is a netlist and a schematic file.
Oh, this is, you're doing the layout side of
and
this.
And mine is the layout side of it. Yeah, it's all about footprints and traces and zones and...
So it does a placement for you, and it also does the routing?
It doesn't do it for you. You have to do them on your own, but it gives you a tool to do it programmatically. So if, for example, you want to place 200 LEDs on aligned lines, you don't have to... drag them and make all of the mistakes of using your trackpad on your laptop. You can just write a loop to do it for you, and if it's the right tool for the mission that you have, it's actually a very efficient tool.
And it's a KiCad plugin?
It's not a plugin, it's its own sort of library, but the output that it gives you is a KiCad file that you can then go and edit manually. So you can do, let's say, LEDs or buttons or whatever you have a lot of, and then you can do the rest of the support circuitry by hand and still have the efficiency.
No, that's really cool. How long have you been using KiCad?
I think I've been using it for about 3 or 4 years, starting with version 4.0 and going as it advances.
What were you using beforehand?
I was not.
Oh, you just...
I was doing manual soldering over perf boards, all of the things that makes the TSA very, very anxious when they see them.
Yeah. That's really neat. I'm trying to think. I haven't interfaced to KiCad the files before. Is it pretty easy to do?
So the way I did it is I reverse and engineered the file formats that they have, more or less.
Okay.
And that's called a no.
We have Chris Gamble joined us here.
But it's doable.
It's doable. If you've ever written any Lisp code, then it would look very, very familiar.
Oh, yeah.
If you have not wrote any Lisp code, then it's still not hard to look at.
We just asked how many people did by raise a hand, and there's like one guy in the back, and he's just like, oh, weird. They don't know. They can't see us. So I'm just saying that we're in front of the audience right now. You know?
Yeah. No. Oh, wow. I thought it was a little more clear.
The other few cool things about it is that once you have your circuit in a programmatic way, you can do a lot more with it. For example, the two things that I have so far that are very useful is exporting your PCB layout into OpenSCAD. So you can actually 3D print it, you can do manipulation on it, you can do other things based on it. And the other very useful thing is actually a very, very fast and cheap way to make a bed of nails.
So, because you already have...
Yeah, you just tell it, here are the edge cuts where I want the spring-loaded latches to catch it, and here are all of the footprints where I want the pogo pins to go, and it just auto-generates it in literally 5 lines of code.
With OpenSCAD?
With OpenSCAD for the 3D printed object, and it actually generates another PCB for the bottom layer, so it can route out all of the connection to you in a comfortable way. Automatically, yeah.
Oh, wow. Is this all on GitHub? Or?
This is all on GitHub. It's in my repo. It's github.com/urielguy/KiCadSharp, or just Google KiCadSharp.
Okay.
And
oh, wow.
It's there. And yeah, let me know if you use it, because that's what keeps me developing it.
Oh, no, I mean, just bed of nail stuff. Like, not enough people do automated testing. Like, I know I've seen the whole badge life thing is pretty big right now. Like, people are making conference badges, and everyone's programming them by hand, or you have, like, plug this thing in, and having a fixture, it's kind of the way industry does it, but it's kind of, there's a barrier of entry for hobbyists, if you will, for smaller scale.
No more.
Yeah. Well,
welcome to the future.
I have to check that out.
Yeah, here, I'll show you one that none of the listeners can see.
Okay.
Ooh, cool, yes.
So what about the, oh, that was good, nice. Yeah. What about the, like, so as someone who doesn't use C-sharp often, did you guys already cover that of like?
No.
Okay, so like, I don't think I've ever used C-sharp. How, like, what about that startup process? Like, is it going to be similar to like a C++ or like pretty simple environment? What does a development environment look like?
I think if you've ever written any C-based language, C-sharp will be very easy to pick up. I think that the best thing that Microsoft does is development tools.
Yeah. And once like Visual Studio and stuff
Visual
like that.
Visual Studio is amazing. Yeah. Visual Studio Code. Yeah. C-sharp is now, by the way, also open source on Linux and Mac if you want, great. The last few months.
And this is not Mono? This is like direct from Microsoft? Or?
This, no, not Mono. They open source it.
Oh,
they,
wow.
They rewrote the compiler in C-sharp and released it for Linux and Mac OS.
That's fantastic. I did not know about that.
So, and they have that, and they have Visual Studio Code, which is an amazing open source IDE as well. And I think it... Once you have a strongly typed language with good development tools, then the entry barrier for anybody using it, you just hit control space or dot, and you just see all of the options. And yeah. For me,
that makes it easier. Yes,
the rigidity kind of helps at the beginning. You're saying,
yeah, like yeah. I think that with good development tools, C# is much easier than, let's say, Python.
Oh, great. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, you're not gonna see the spaces and all the
yeah.
No, but just like the tab complete when you're like you have an object and you say dot and then these are the three functions you can call with it.
Yeah, that is nice.
As a beginner, it definitely helps.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, that's great. I mean, your project is awesome. The build is like really nice. Did you talk about the bending of the PCB already?
I did not.
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick too. Because this is, so like to describe what this is a ski mask with an array of LEDs. But it's a thin enough PCB that it was actually bent around the ski mask.
Were you wearing this outside yesterday?
Yes, I was.
Oh, so I did see you. Okay.
Right. That LED person.
Hook this up.
Yeah. And so basically it's a way to kind of show. It's like a, well, like Garrett Mace has those LED glasses.
Yeah, but this
as well.
Is machine like.
But it's also see-through because the there's cutouts in between each pixel.
Yeah, it's a PCB made mostly out of holes.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Swiss cheese.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then, but what about the bending process? Because that was really interesting to me.
So the bending process, so initially I tried going with a flex PCB.
Mm-hmm.
And that was both more expensive to manufacture and it was actually a lot more fragile to deal and
right.
with the corners and putting it in and didn't last very long. So what I tried next is I just went with 0.6 millimeter PCBs.
Mm-hmm.
And those are apparently, the radius here, I think it's something like 120 millimeters. And those just bend well enough around that. And what's holding it in place is actually each LED is glued to the lens of the goggles.
Mm.
These are like ski goggles, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, these are motocross goggles. Ski goggles are too fancy for this.
So it's a motorcycle. Okay, I see.
Yeah. Like the double lensing.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you the difference.
Yeah, right.
Well, you know, like any project, once you get into it, you start
you learn
all
these,
of the,
right.
the minute details. So.
What if you're taking these to the playa, too, for Burning Man? I'm sure that
These
ski goggles would be a little heavier and less
ventilated, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, these were born for Burning Man. Yeah.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they look like you'd be able to be spotted as a burner from a long way away.
Yeah, these go well, like, you know, that's my... talked about in my talk. I have another project called Touchy Blinky, which is a 15x6 interactive LED wall.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And the main
15x6 feet?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
We're
large pixels.
Yeah, like they're all made of takeout containers and bounty.
Yep.
And each one is also a button, but the problem with a 15-foot wall is that you can't take it with you.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't know that you did it. So this is just like a smaller version.
It's part of
it.
It's like a calling card on your face. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's
like,
great.
Oh, you like this? Go see the bigger one.
Yeah, right. Awesome.
Really neat.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to us. This has been
this
really good.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Thanks for having me.
And where can people find you online?
I have a website called urailguy.com where I sometimes post stuff that I do and on GitHub mostly.
Awesome.
Great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
We're here at KaiCon. 2019, the only KaiCon there's been so far, and this is Alvaro with the Unnamed Reverse Engineering podcast, and we have our guest is...
I'm Steve Kulov. I own, with my business partner, HD Retrovision, and we make technologies for retro game consoles and other retro technology, legacy technology. We're trying to bring them into the new high-definition age, I guess.
So this is like arcade, Nintendo, all...
Yeah, mostly home console type stuff. The arcade stuff's a whole nother beast. But, I mean, we've done Neo Geo stuff, and that's...
Oh, wow, yeah.
That even though the home version is a home version, it's still based on the arcade hardware, so...
And so are you... what are you doing with the hardware to get it into the modern times, I guess?
So... What we've mainly made thus far is component video cables for Sega Genesis and Super Nintendo. And what they do is they take the raw red, green, and blue outputs out the back of the console, and they do a color space conversion all in analog circuitry. So like op amps, operational amplifiers, they just do math on voltages, basically. And then you get the output, and... we send it through some high quality coaxial cabling, and so TVs with component inputs can get this really high quality signal that was mainly meant for Europe because they had like a weird connector called SCART.
Okay.
Yeah. So involved in that type of stuff is we had to write our own test software. So we had to make cartridges for Genesis and Super Nintendo.
Do they like test patterns?
And they draw test patterns, and we measure all those voltages on the oscilloscope and get values and create approximations, averages, and so we know how to what gains to put on our analog circuitry.
So why keep it component? And like, I know a lot of the new ones do HDMI, right? And then just go full for digital.
So this was conceptualized back in like 2011, 2012. And so there's two reasons. One, when we founded the company, we kind of wanted to split the task into two parts because we definitely do want to do the digital stuff.
Yeah.
So we first wanted to get the best analog output we could that's compatible with stuff people could use right now. So TVs that had it, people even use it on old CRT TVs that have component inputs, so they get really good quality off that too. So, and then the other half is like the HDMI output scaler video processor that would take any old analog signal. And so the two would interface to each other. And so we're in the process of working on that stuff right now. We just got an HDMI license last fall/winter. So we're making progress on that stuff too.
And I assume a lot of this stuff, most of the documentation is by hobby or like by fans, right? Like how have you been dealing with that?
I've learned early on that most of the documentation online is flawed. So I've learned to just do all the measurements myself, do all the checks herself, you know, the test software stuff. There were other test softwares, but I don't know how they were written. They weren't open source. But we needed to be certain that things were right because we're selling a product. We're asking people for money in exchange for this, right?
Yeah.
So it needs to be done correctly. I would not be comfortable just not knowing how that test software was written. And so we wrote the test software. We made carts. We published it on our site open source so people can see that we did the measurements correctly if they wanted to, and they could use it for their own projects and stuff like that.
And each different console, I'm sure it's a totally different way of writing to a cartridge. So
we started with the Sega Genesis, which was kind of the easiest because there's a guy in France who made the SGDK, Sega Genesis Development Kit. And so it was, you know, a bunch of C libraries and tools to compile for Motorola 68K, which is what the Sega Genesis or the Mega Drive they call in Europe and Japan. That's what they used. So that was the easiest one. And then I had to do the Super Nintendo stuff. And the easiest path to do Super Nintendo stuff was actually writing it in assembly. And so it's 68516 assembly. And I think the only other computer they used that was like an Apple computer of some kind. I forgot what generation Apple computer had it, but it's a very rare processor. It's basically a 6502
with extra
that you
can
put in 16-bit mode.
Oh, okay.
But I've noticed when I was writing the software, the assembler would have a hard time tracking of when you're in 16-bit and when you're in 8-bit, especially when you're jumping to subroutines and doing interrupts, where I just kept the chip in 8-bit mode too.
The whole time.
Because I didn't really need speed. I was drawing a pattern up and then just leaving it there until somebody pressed another button to change the pattern.
And how do you know, which instructions to use to draw? Like, so you have the development kit for that one, but for are all these consoles said fairly well known that
there's some nice homebrew guides for writing homebrew on. I think it was just SNES development, SNES development. .com or .org or something. There were some guides to get you started. There was stuff that wasn't there that we needed to figure out ourselves. There was a sound chip for Super Nintendo that is its own CPU, basically, so you have to write a little assembly program for so that CPU.
For sound.
For all we really needed was to check left channel and right channel if it was wired up correctly, because we weren't really doing anything with audio, but we needed to make sure that the white RCA cable was left and the red was right. So we wanted a little check in there. So it took a lot of time, but we ended up getting like a ding sound in the left and a ding sound in the right. Same thing with the Sega Genesis. We had to write our own, like, we had to track our own little program and our own little sound file and push it to the cartridge.
That's pretty neat. Yeah. And connectors in the back, like, I know these were all proprietary, at least for the Super Nintendo it was this weird shape. Are those widely available, or do you have to make your own?
So we kind of got lucky on the Super Nintendo ones because, well, so there's a lot of other cable makers, they just make the crappiest yellow, white, red composite cables, right? But they populate all the pins. So the RGB pins that we needed and the additional 5-volt pin, because our circuit needs 5-volt power, all the pins were there. And so, I mean, it took a while for our factory to find a source that we deal with a higher quality factory and they need like sourcing documentation, like Rose certifications and stuff like that. It took a while for them to find it, but they eventually found Super Nintendo / N64 analog connector. The Sega Genesis connector is a Mini DIN 9, which is kind of, it's standard, but it's not that common. But you can still find it. Again, those people who are making the composite cables,
they would use it.
So there were sources there. The hardest connector it took to find was the Sega Saturn, which is a Mini DIN 10, and this PlayStation connector was the hard. PlayStation connector, all the third-party ones all these companies were using for composite had a force that was way too tight and was not comfortable with how tight it felt.
The insertion force?
The insertion and the removal force.
Okay.
And so I took a force gauge and I was doing tests on stuff and I got my own specs. And we were trying to actually get a factory to make...
Just thinner or wider?
To make, it ended up being the pins themselves. On the original Sony connector, there were like these pins that are bent backwards and they're kind of springy.
Yeah.
And so the insertion force on those wasn't that much. But on these aftermarket connectors, it was just like a flat big piece of metal with where the springy U-shaped part would be. It would be solid metal. And so you're pushing all these 12 pins of solid metal in. And removing it, and I was not comfortable with that, and we spent probably almost a year trying to find a connector, and we had to get a solution, like a compromise solution, which was we had our factory pull unused pins out of the aftermarket connector that had the white tabs.
Yeah.
And so we only used what we needed. And it was a middle ground where it was still a little tight, but it wasn't
where a lot better.
Feel like you were going to break somebody's childhood console, right?
Wow. That's crazy. I guess your main customers are streamers or like retro?
They're actually, I think our main customers are just us, like people,
nerds.
I'm assuming 30s.
Yeah.
People in their 30s who grew up with this stuff kind of want to get back into it, and the emulator stuff just doesn't really do it for them. They want to pick up the controller.
And it's the same, it's the original console, right?
Right. Still. Yeah, they want to pick up the old controller. They want low input lag, input latency. They want to pop their cartridge in, and they want it to look decent on their newer displays. So that's mostly what it is. I mean, we get a lot of people who are like, you know, they have families now, and it's like, this is the greatest thing ever. I get to play with my son or daughter or whatever. It's pretty much people who like the nostalgia, but there's younger people who are into it too.
That's super cool. How long have you been doing that?
I've looked at Sega Genesis video signals probably since 2008, but it hasn't been consistent since then. I did a little bit in 2008, did a little bit more in 2011, 2012. We didn't found our company officially until 2014. That's when we had a Kickstarter in November of 2014. And since then, it's been nonstop work.
Is this your full-time?
It is now, just recently, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm surviving mostly on saved up money right now. So,
Hopefully it goes well. People are always reverse engineering podcasts, so people ask reverse engineering, and then I keep telling people that looking at old gear that's not well documented and just figuring out how it works.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, I mean, another hard task we had to do is, you know, we like I said, we wrote test software and put it on the consoles, but there were 9 different revisions of the original Super Nintendo.
Yeah, how do you know the difference?
We had to find all 9 of them. They're not explicitly known from the outside, so you have to crack open cases and look at the silkscreen on the board. And so we had to, I still have them in our closet.
Are those differences well documented as well, or well known in the community?
No, not really. I have a friend and colleague who he runs RetroRGB.com. His name is Bob. He does a podcast with me and 3 other guys called the Retro Roundtable. He runs RetroRGB.com, and he tries to have a go-to place with all this information on it.
Oh, so this is all documented now on this?
We haven't officially released all our spreadsheets of anything yet, but it's something I'm open to doing in the future at some point.
Well, I'm sure
probably when I have time and other stuff.
Yeah, people would love that.
It's definitely something. When we're in the middle of developing things, we like to stay a little bit quiet on stuff, but then once things are out there, we're really good with sharing, especially if you listen to our podcast. All I do is talk about design problems I've solved on stuff that I've been working on.
I'll have to check it out. Thank you so much. I think talks are starting again, but thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online?
Nowhere really. Our company does have a Twitter at HD Retrovision. My business partner Nick runs that. He's the social media guy.
That's fine.
There's also the retroroundtable.com is
the podcast.
It'll link you to the YouTube archives of our live streams.
Okay.
And other than that,
No, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks.
We're back again. This is Alvaro and
Peter.
And our guest is
Craig.
Craig, welcome to the Empower at KeyCon.
Thank you.
How do you enjoy it so far?
This has been amazing. I think I've been to a lot of conferences for like industry before, and this is the first open source conference I've been to, and it's by far the most fun conference I've been to yet.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, what your background is?
Sure. So I'm an electrical engineer by childhood and school, and I'm a software engineer by childhood and job.
Okay.
So, So I started into electronics and software because I always wanted to make games, and I wasn't satisfied with just doing the software. I also wanted to make my game console. So back in high school, I followed a bunch of people online, had all these wonderful projects where you'd use a PIC micro to generate NTSC video signals, and some of them were nice enough to publish online about it, and it was really easy to get the free microchip PIC samples.
Yes.
Somehow managed to make an assembly loop that spit out NTSC video, and then finally got more complicated with like a ARM microcontroller and a SRAM for a frame buffer and all that stuff, and writing the software. So it is like love at first sight with hardware combined with software. So haven't been able to escape it.
So what? When did you start using KiCad?
Let's see, 8 years ago, 9 years ago now.
Oh wow!
I think now you win, right?
Yeah, or, you have the record.
I don't even know if it, maybe I'm wrong because it might not have been out by then, but I used GEDA, GEDA before that.
And yeah, I tried to use GEDA PCB first.
Yeah.
Before how do you switch from GEDA PCB to KiCad because of features or?
Well, at my previous company that I worked at before going independent, we had access to all the CAD tools, like all the Cadence tools and stuff like that. And after using these really expensive tools, like crazy price tools, and realizing how badly they suck, and they still have terrible unintuitive UIs, they still don't do exactly what you want. When I was doing stuff for hobby or doing stuff independent afterwards, I thought, well, KiCad has all the functionality, and everyone complains about its UI, but it's actually really good even when you compare against the commercial tools, because CAD UI is complicated. So, and it lets all your projects actually be free and open source. So that's cool.
Yeah, and so what do you miss from these tools that KiCad doesn't have, if any?
Like, maybe this is a very weird specific thing, but if you're using big BGA packages, your BGA, a lot of people don't think about it, but when you're doing trace length matching, you don't just match the length of the trace on the circuit board, but there's actually an even tinier trace.
Bond wire?
Yeah, bond wire, or like if it's a substrate, which is like a little tiny PCB inside the chip, that has a trace too, and it has some length. So, and the big boy tools would have tools for, you know, you put in those
trace
lengths.
You add that, like, extra trim.
So basically with the package, you define what the trace lengths inside the chip are.
Yeah.
That would be in the commercial software.
Yep. And if you're lucky, the manufacturer gives you a little thing you can import.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky, there is a file format, exchange format for this?
Yep. So.
That's actually a very, very interesting feature. It's like the people are moving into more and more complex boards.
And when we start doing
bigger
DDR3,
and bigger
DDR,
chips,
like,
so that's definitely useful.
Yeah, and to be honest, nobody has really cracked the problem of how to handle the giant chips like that. Like, I was really impressed with Dave's talk this morning about using text-based schematic definition and Skittle. Because I'm passionate about that because I think it's the future, because today you have a schematic and it has a giant box with 1,000 pins, and they all have a label. And then there's another box on a different page with 1,000 pins, and they all have a label, and you got to find which label goes to what. And it makes the visual schematic not useful at all. So,
for me, the comparison is HDL.
Yeah.
It's like you want to design very complex digital. It's like, yes, of course, you can use some graphical user interface to pull traces, but everyone who I know who does HDL, sooner or later is like, this is just a mess and rat's nest afterwards, so it's easier to actually write Verilog.
Exactly. Well, you could use Verilog if you really wanted to for PCBs, but I don't recommend it. And I think we'll see a big evolution of PCB description languages, or maybe even just like circuit description language.
Especially for the really, really complex boards, like you say, right? Because for simple stuff,
even if you have one FPGA with like one DRAM, that's complicated enough that you want an HDL. And the crazy thing too is like every time you do a board with a DRAM like that, DRAM's all spec driven. Like there's
I'm not innovating at all with how I
connect my... No, you just use their design, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you tweak anything and forget about it.
Take the data sheet, copy exactly what they said.
Exactly.
And hope for the best.
Or it's kind of funny, even like small parts. Like today what you do is you open the data sheet, you look at the application circuit, and you try to copy that into your schematic editor. Why can't that be a library that I just plunked down?
Yeah.
Yeah, so. But to be fair, it's like, especially with FPGAs, the data sheets more often than not contain even wrong reference schematics. Yep. I ran into that with even
sample
small
code
stuff.
As well, yeah.
Yep, yep, always the case.
So you mentioned you're running your own business now, or do consulting? Or?
So from 2010 to last year, I worked at a place called Deca Technologies. It was a semiconductor packaging company. And I worked on software for redesigning semiconductor package patterns on the fly there. And part of that was auto routing. And I had a huge passion about auto routing now after diving into the guts for it. And I left there last year, started a consulting firm. And since then, now I want to start a product company because PCB design is broken and it needs fixing. So, and there's a lot of pieces to it. Like, it was interesting, Dimitri from CAD Lab did a talk today, and he's doing another part of it, you know, for diffs, visual diffs on PCB design. So
that would be nice.
I think it's happening.
Yeah, I can't wait for the moment where you go on GitHub and actually see the diff when you open this.
I know.
Off the schematic or the board design. Oh, I'm looking so forward to that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So you're working on auto routers?
Yeah, so there's all kinds of ways to attack the future PCB design, but I had developed appreciation for the intricate guts of auto routing algorithms while I was at my previous company, and so it's a rare position to be actually able to innovate on that, and it's a field that hasn't seen a whole lot of love in the last couple decades. Like current state-of-the-art routing algorithms are still what we developed in like 1992. Mm-hmm. So
we have a lot more cores now, like
parallel. Yeah. Well, we have cloud. Like, why does my routing have to run on my laptop and make it warm?
Why
can't it go in the cloud? Why can't I use 100 servers? So
yeah, have you looked at, for example, NextPNR, the place and router for FPGA, the open source one?
No, I haven't, and I've been meaning to dig into that because that looks
there might be some interesting overlap.
Yeah. It's interesting though because like IC routing. Completely diverged from PCB routing, and it's gotten tons of love because you can't physically route an IC if you wanted to. So,
yeah, it's much, it's complex.
Right, exactly.
And are you running these auto routers on KiCad?
So our plan is maybe we'll be the first commercial plugin for KiCad.
Ooh,
wow.
Maybe, I don't know.
That would be cool.
But I think it could be awesome.
Open source ecosystems.
Like
right?
WordPress, it's open source platform. And it has lots of open source plugins, but it also has a commercial community.
Yeah.
I think it could grow like that.
Well, I think that's great because then it actually funds the development of KiCad.
Exactly.
Like, it's
like if you saw in Dimitri's talk, or not Dimitri, the Eisler talk, they had whenever you buy something through the company, they donate to KiCad. Mm-hmm. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Oshpark's running that too.
Oshpark is doing that, I think. And I think commercial users, I donate my Eagle license fees to and then a lot of other people do that.
Yeah,
it's like we should share that on Twitter so that people do that. It's like
the big donate button.
Yeah,
all about it.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online if you want to be found online?
So I have a blog that I sometimes post to at craigjb.com, but all my other contact info is there too. So
all right, craigjb.com.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.